For everyone who loves books, this is Read On.
Hi, I'm Garrick Hagan, and you're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up in this week's show, Garrick Hagan discusses audiobooks, acting, and Star Wars.
I was very moved myself by the end. I know you shouldn't be moved when you're reading a text, but I was extremely moved reading it.
Faye Weldon takes the long view of feminism.
At the moment, not all that much need for it, in my view, which can which can make me unpopular.
Joanne Harris reveals some extreme reactions to her novel about a blind character.
And it is one of my three kind of unreliable narrator psychological thriller books. It's the one that I get the most hate mail about when people hate it.
And the winner of last year's Philip Carnegie Medal for Children's Fiction shares the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Garrick Hagan has narrated more than 130 talking books for the RNIB Library. Fans of Stephen King, Tom Clancy, James Patterson and many other best-selling authors will recognise his voice immediately. But that's far from his only contribution to the world of storytelling. He and his wife, narrator Liza Ross, run The Story Circle, a leading audiobook production company. And among his many on-screen credits is his role as Biggs Darklighter in Star Wars: A New Hope. So, when he popped into the studio, my only problem was where to start. Garrick Hagan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, today you're here at the RNIB studios in your capacity as a producer. I was looking through the list. You've produced over 150 audiobooks of all genres. That must make you one of the most busy audiobook production companies in the country, I would have thought.
Oh, that's a nice thought, but I try to mix it with my acting work, and so it's always taken up spaces in between acting jobs. But I have been lucky because I've had a whole series of excellent books and wonderful readers. I've been privileged to work with, for example, Ian McKellen, Julie Walters, Joan Collins, Charles Spencer, many, many people who I wouldn't have met in my normal workaday life. And I consider that one of the great benefits of producing, aside from the fact that I've had an awful lot of very good books to do. I could go on forever, but the one big starting point to the success of The Story Circle was working on His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman's book, and we did that over a number of years as he kept writing them, and I did that with a whole full cast productions on each one of the books in the trilogy.
That certainly brought the kind of ensemble actor cast that you get in radio drama into the world of audiobooks, which is something that I can't remember having been done before, and really brought the book and its many characters completely and utterly to life.
Yeah, the producer was Tim Ditlow in Random House, a well-listening library in New York. And he had been working with Bruce Colville, and sort of he got used to doing multi-voice productions of children's books. And he heard some of the productions we'd started with. My daughter had the idea of us doing point horror books from Scholastic, and they were short enough and involved children's characters. And so we were able to adapt these stories very easily and well, and present them rather like old-time radio. I grew up in radio. When I was a kid, I worked in Canada on CBC radio a lot, very young. And I always remembered those days with great fondness and wanted to reproduce them when we did Point Horror. And we did eight productions for Scholastic, and they were all I still look back on them, and believe me, I couldn't believe it. They're on YouTube now. Some of them have been just uploaded onto YouTube, without pictures, of course, just as our productions, and they're quite old, but they're still listened to and enjoyed.
Tess saw the figure as just a blur, but something struck her as strange. Instead of rushing to the boardwalk to help, the figure was moving away from the scene. Was it going for help, Tess wondered? But why not use the phones nearby? And what was it doing under the devil's elbow in the first place?
They asked for it. They did. They had it coming, all of them. They get no sympathy. They think it was an accident. Wrong.
And today you're in the studio working with another multi-talented man, Mark Billingham. You're recording his latest Tom Thorne.
Yes, it's the newest one. He's just written it, and we're actually recording it. And Mark is discovering commas and slight things he's changing as we go. But he's a wonderful reader, and as you say, he's an actor as well, comedian as well, so he's a wonderful ear. And we've worked together on a number of his books with him narrating, and also done a book. The last one that we did was Love Like Blood, has a number of other actors in it who also work with the RNIB quite a bit. And that, I must mention, a lot of the actors I've worked with have been either trained or read for the RNIB. And it's a wonderful place to gain experience for actors in general. And, you have a lot of professional actors who have read for years. It's a great company to draw on for actors in other productions.
Well, I sit just outside the green room and I listen to you on your coffee breaks and your lunch breaks, and the richness of the voices and the stories, and you're clearly a very close bunch. You clearly meet each other quite often at the RNIB studios and at other studios and swap your stories and the tales of the books that you've been narrating.
Yeah, everybody always asks, what are you reading? What are you doing now? And but it is nice when you meet outside the RNIB. It's like meeting another club member, if you like. You say, where have I seen you before? Oh, yes, it's the RNIB. Isn't that wonderful? And I met Sean Phillips last weekend at a convention, and, you know, she's another reader, Richard Franklin. So people that you often meet in conventions who you don't realize have been readers, and then you suddenly have a bond.
There also seem to be quite a lot of former actors from The Archers. You, of course, played the rather rascally Simon in The Archers. And recently I was talking to Caroline Lennon, who described herself as the Irish slapper from The Archers.
Quite we were both rogues in our various ways and both ejected finally.
the Archers rogue survivors. Maybe there's a series in it. You never know.
Well, and then I've met Graham Seed here, who was had that epic fall from the roof, and I you know, yes, there are an awful lot of RNIB actors who have also worked on the Archers. And I did a production of Alice in Wonderland here. Roz Adams worked in that, as did other Archer's actors. And Richard Wilson. I had Richard Wilson in that. So, yeah, it's a wonderful community, the voice community anyway. And especially, I must put a word in for the American, Canadian, or altogether North American actors who read here and read elsewhere. I've done a lot of work with them over the years. It's been a wonderful place for me to connect with other actors and actors to meet with each other.
Now, I was scrolling through a list of the talking books that you've narrated at the RNIB, and do you realise you've done over 130 of them? And a large number of Lee Child, Tom Clancy.
Yeah, large books.
And one of my personal favourites, actually, Killer in the Rain by Raymond Chandler.
Oh.
You really do seem to have Marlowe's laconic, world-weary voice down to a T. Do you have a favourite that you've narrated?
I guess my favourite book in an adult capacity was John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and partly because, well, it's such a moving story, and it's a meaningful story. It has such resonance with the life in early 20th century America. So it's a great book, that's all. And I was very moved myself by the end. I know you shouldn't be moved when you're reading a text, but I was extremely moved reading it.
I think most readers would say it's actually quite difficult not to cry at the end of The Grapes of Wrath. And
yeah.
Yes, I can imagine it must have brought a lump to the throat. Most of the books I mentioned were thrillers, but as you say, you've narrated a lot of classic literature and actually some factual books as well. I was reading something about the reconstruction of Baghdad recently, which
I
had
know.
Your voice.
Yeah, when I think of it, I wish in a way that I could remember the wonderful nonfiction books that I've read so I could quote some of these facts, because, of course, Iraq has come up so often in our conversations, and that was a wonderful book. I only regret not having a photographic memory. One of the major fiction books I've read, and one of the best American writers, was John Updike. And that was a great privilege, because I did the Rabbit Trilogy, and then I wrote to him, and I said, you know, I am so pleased to have finished with Norman Mailer's Harlot's Ghost. And this was for the Arnabee. And I said, I'm so pleased to be getting on to your book, which was a book of essays equally long as Harlot's Ghost, over 1,000 pages, both of them. And John Updike wrote me back a little note, because I sort of played on the fact that he wasn't a great friend of Norman Mailer, as far as I could understand. And I got this nice little note back. Nothing against Norman Mailer, but just appreciating the fact that I appreciated getting into his book after Norman Mailer. And then when I met him, he came over for a talk, and I lined up and met him, and he said to Garrick, he wrote in his book, the only man in the world besides myself who has read every single word of Odd Jobs, which was a lovely little inscription.
Now, your wife, Liza Ross, is also a narrator and works with you, is co-founder of the Story Circle as well. Mm. Do you discuss the books that you're narrating and producing between you? Do you have similar tastes?
Liza reads a lot more than I do, just reads for leisure more than I do. I seem to be working on books that I'm producing. But Liza is great at organizing, so she schedules the multi-voices and does it rather like a film production assistant or location manager, all combined. And that's a great facility, and it works terribly well. And in fact, The Man on the Mountaintop, she actually directed. I, in the end, didn't direct it myself. That was with Toby Jones and Stanley Tucci and a cast, and she did a marvelous job. So she's not only a good reader, but she's very good adapter and organizer, and in fact, directing.
And is your house full of books, paper copy books, or are you electronic readers, or do you listen to audiobooks?
Well, we have a house full of books, which we're rapidly trying to get rid of because nobody wants them anymore, and we're going to move. But Liza reads an awful lot now on the Kindle. I am less on a Kindle. I like paperback and books and the paper itself. And occasionally we listen to audiobooks, but we don't have a great deal of time. We don't even listen to a lot of the books we produce in the end after editing them and finished. That's it, because we're moving really always on into other productions. And right now we've got another multi-voice, which we hope to do here at the RNIB. That we want to do. So we're lucky in that sense. Audiobooks have meant a great deal to us, and it's been a great addition to the acting work and all the other voice work we do. We've been extremely lucky in that respect.
And you mentioned the acting work. I couldn't conduct an interview with you without mentioning Star Wars, the gift that keeps on giving as far as you're concerned, really.
I've got to thank Star Wars for taking me to places I would never have been. It lives on for us veterans because we go around doing conventions occasionally, and like next week I'm off to Denmark, and then I go to Albuquerque in America and so on. It's just fun, and the fans are pretty fantastic, and some of them actually come up and say, I've listened to you on audio. And I had one chap up in Scotland, he came up and said, I've just finished Tom Clancy's The Bear and the Dragon. And gosh, that was 26 hours. So there's a nice crossover. Yeah, I got to say, old big Starglider comes roaring into play every so often. And I love meeting the people who still remember that character.
Well, big Starglider, Garrick Hagen, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
Killer in the Rain. We were sitting in a room at the Berglund. I was on the side of the bed, and Dravik was in the easy chair. It was my room. Rain beat very hard against the windows. They were shut tight, and it was hot in the room, and I had a little fan going on the table. The breeze from it hit Dravik's face high up, lifted his heavy black hair, moved the longer bristles in the fat path of eyebrow that went across his face in a solid line. He looked like a bouncer who had come into money. He showed me some of his gold teeth and said, "What you got on me?" He said it importantly, as if anyone who knew anything would know quite a lot about him. "Nothing," I said. "You're clean, as far as I know." He lifted a large, hairy hand and stared at it solidly for a minute. "You don't get me. A fella named McGee sent me here. Violets McGee." "Fine. How is Violets these days?" Violets McGee was a homicide dick in the sheriff's office. He looked at his large hand and frowned. "No, you still don't get it. I got a job for you."
My guest, Garrick Hagen, narrating the title story from Killer in the Rain by Raymond Chandler, which is TB9249. For a full list of talking books narrated by Garrick, go to the website rniblibrary.org or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. And Garrick will be back later in the show to introduce one of his favourite books.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come, Joanne Harris will be exploring the senses through writing and Ruta Sepetys will bring us the books of her life. But first, it's not often that Read On producer Robert Kirkwood is apprehensive before an interview, but our next guest does come with quite a formidable reputation. Faye Weldon is as outspoken as she is prolific. With the first of her Love and Inheritance trilogy, Habits of the House, entering the RNIB library, she joined Robert down the line. He began with a tentative question.
Now, am I right in saying it's rather unusual that you're interviewed by a man?
Oh, no, it's not true. I actually prefer being interviewed by men because one can have kind of arguments with them, you know.
Now, Habits of the House is a sort of return to your early days, as it is echoes of the first ever episode of Upstairs, Downstairs, which you wrote.
Yes, that's true. And in a way, it's because I couldn't do what I wanted in upstairs, downstairs. That I ended up, years, decades later, sort of ended up writing what I wanted to write more about this particular period.
Now, you're almost as famous for some of the things you've said as opposed to some of the books you've written, and your rather unique view of feminism.
Well, I don't know what the kind of normal attitude is. I mean, these days, you know, if I teach students, and if you say feminism to them, they're completely horrified because they think it means they don't like men or they won't wear lipstick or they'll argue too much. And all this is rather sad, I think. I mean, I never wrote as if I was a feminist. People said I was feminist. I mean, what I was doing was, and still am, is presenting a view of life as I see it, as it goes on around me. And if there are sort of strains in it which can be interpreted as feminist, that is to say women are having a raw and unfair deal, then it will be there in the book. And in the early books it was, because I think in those days women did have a much worse time than they do now. Nowadays, you would hardly call them feminist because there is, at the moment, not all that much need for it, in my view, which can, which can make me unpopular with some, as you might say, proper feminists who think women always have a bad time. But I think it depends what culture you're in.
Although when you look at things like, say, the everyday sexism account on Twitter and the shocking examples it finds on a daily basis even now, many might say that your arguments from back in the day are still valid.
Well, it's true, you see. I was writing about a book I wrote in 1968, 69, and it's still, or quite a lot of it seems valid today, which is rather an alarming thought, in which women are seen and do see themselves as kind of in relation to the men in their lives.
Mm.
That is, their sort of daughters or sisters or wives or mothers, and see that as a great role. Well, I mean, for a lot of women, I think it is, and some women, you know, this is what life is, and I think it's a perfectly noble life, really, which is in which you sacrifice your own ego or convenience for the sake of everyone else in the family. And somebody needs to do it, and they do it, and good for them. Other women just can't stand the domestic life at all. I don't think that's changed for the centuries. Some women are suited to it, and some women aren't.
Now, bringing things up to date, even though this concerns some of your earlier books, but you're entering the fray against Google, who have scanned some of your copywritten material.
Well, I'm a sort of test case for the American Society of Authors, against the Hathi Trust, who has been, which is a group of universities who have been putting everything, copyright material without anyone's permission online. Now, you know, it may be a good thing they are online, but at the same time, you do have to ask the people if they mind or not, and they ask me.
Do you think, though, that that's an inevitable consequence of the digital revolution?
No, I don't think it is. I think if that happens, it makes it, I mean, if you're not going to pay writers for what they write, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to turn into an amateur profession rather than a profession in which you can expect to sort of earn a living. And writers will have to go back to being writing in garrets and never giving up a day job, which is, you know, it's not the worst fate in the world, but it is going to be a great upheaval to the way writers have been working for the last 100 years.
It almost seems like what's happened in the music industry, because
the parallels are very great indeed, yes.
Musicians at the moment simply aren't getting paid for their records. They're getting paid for touring, but touring is not something a writer can do.
No, but I mean, in a kind of way, you know, what we're doing now is a sort of touring, you know, because one's presenting oneself to, to an audience, but this is as far as it will go, you know. And not a great deal of money changes hands, certainly.
Yeah, that's the trouble. You can't charge £80 a ticket, though.
No, exactly. And there's only one of you, and at least in a group, you know, there's a whole group of you to dance about on a stage. Well, you don't get many writers dancing around on the stage.
Now, getting back to your very early work, one question I've got to ask, does vodka get you drunker quicker?
Yes, vodka does get you drunker quicker. But the clown doesn't really need to know, or doesn't really want to know, because, you know, people who make vodka don't want to think they're trying to make people drunk, trying to make them think they're sort of, you know, they're kind of grand and classy and cool. It's a good, you know, alcohol's a rather vulgar word.
Now, that was a famously rejected advertising slogan. Now, with your early work in copywriting and also your views on feminism, maybe a silly question, but do you ever watch the TV show Mad Men?
Yes, I did, and that was me. What was her name? Peggy Olson. I was Peggy Olson. Actually, the sister agency to the one that was in the film. So, yes, I mean, that was what it was like in those days, and they were enormous fun, I may say. But, you know, it was... The world then was very, very different in what it saw as moral or acceptable than it is now, and I'm sure now is probably a great deal better.
Now,
unless if you lived through that, it wasn't all that bad.
Now, historically, how different were the morals at the time when you were in advertising to the time you wrote about in your new novel and, indeed, in Upstairs, Downstairs?
Well, Upstairs, Downstairs was at the turn of the century, as the new novel is. And by the time you got to the 60s, you were into the age of permissiveness, really, and the sort of and the age of contraception, which, of course, was what made the great difference, I think, in the days when sex and babies were inextricably linked. Sex was a very serious matter, You didn't likely either become married, or then you would have babies. So what a woman was in those days was somebody who had babies. So you couldn't have baby, you couldn't have sex until you got married. You couldn't have babies until you got married and had somebody to support the baby. So it was, you know, I think that those early times, 100 years ago, are rather misjudged, because it seems people were being incredibly respectable, but actually, they're not talking about respectability so much as a social necessity, that if a girl had a baby, there wasn't enough food, who's going to feed it? You know, so you get a whole culture which is saying sort of extramarital sex is a sort of dangerous and terrible thing. Then you move into the 60s, where you have contraception and sex suddenly becomes available to everybody, and people lose any sense of a sort of morality at all, which is now returning into something which can be, I think, sometimes rather over the top, but is nevertheless probably an improvement on what went before.
How important is the audio format to you?
But I have recorded a few myself, and it's really nice to do, you know, because it's kind of entertaining for you and gratifying to be able to do it. I mean, I've been listening to the Cassavetes on the radio, because somebody sent me a DVD of it, a DCD of it to listen to, and it just works so well, doesn't it? It's so lovely to have things read to you, which, when they're good to read, and, you know, and there's enough in it to keep you, you know, to keep you interested and want to go on listening. But it's the same, you see, if you're right. But I do quite a lot of radio drama, and started writing. My initial writing was all in television, so it's very automatic of me to write as people speak, so that it comes over, I like to think. I mean, writing for the page is slightly different from writing for sound, what you hear with your ears, not what you see with your eyes. And it's almost a different kind of writing, but that's the kind of writing I do anyway, so it works, at least I hope it does.
Now, I'm assuming that while you're writing the way people speak, there's a huge difference between, say, some of your sci-fi work or something that you've written at the turn of the century.
Yes, they're all different, and I think you do have to have an ear for speech. But actually, you see, if you are writing dialogue, you don't write as it is said, as you hear if you listen to it, because it's more formalized by that than that. It's a kind of formalized version. If you listen to what people are actually saying, it's full of pauses and inaccuracies and grammatical mistakes. And if you listen to yourself, I mean, if you read what you've been to talking about in an interview, it's much sloppier than anything you'll find written down, even in dialogue. So it is a kind of formalized approach in which you have to sort of give the essence of reality, but not quite the reality.
Different. Yeah, I think some things really lend themselves to audio, and also on the other side of that coin, some things really don't.
No, but that does make a sense. It makes sense to me, because it is, well, you know, reading things off a page is a different process than listening to something. I mean, they both make sense, but they come over in a different way, and you either write for it one way or for the other. So, no, that makes sense to me. I think the actual process of writing is completely sort of fascinating, and the relationship between who's writing and the listener or the reader is very complex indeed, and how you perceive and how you get things into your mind or move things from somebody, one person's head into another via the sight or sound. It's just a really interesting process. I think it can happen at all, it always seems to me.
Did you find it gained an extra layer when you were actually narrating the book as well?
Oh, yes, of course it does. Yes, no, you see, you know, and you end up really rather pleased with yourself, because you can see that, you know, what you've done has actually worked. It is a different process. And, you know, I mean, one has a terrible tendency to sort of almost fall in love with your own words, you see. I have some things in music, I mean, some sort of... I've written an opera or two, and one of which we're trying to get made. One's filmed and the other was sung, and was just a children's opera. But it is so flattering to have your music set, your words set to music, that you think, goodness, did I actually write that? And you do see this other dimension there, which you hardly notice when you write at all. So I'm really pleased by the whole process.
There are 30 books by Faye Wilden available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and we're at the end of the interview and we haven't fought at all.
I know.
That's a kind of shame. I would have. I shouldn't have said that at the end of this.
No. Oh, no, of course you should.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and Faye Wilden. Habits of the House, narrated by Rula Lenska, is TB20173. And, as Robert said, many of her other books are also available from the RNIB Library in a range of accessible formats.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, the winner of last year's Silip Carnegie Medal, Ruta Sepetys, will be bringing us the books of her life. And Garrick Hagen shares one of his favourite reads. But first... Author Joanne Harris is probably best known for her hugely successful novel, Chocolat, which is a mouth-watering exploration of our sense of taste. As we'll hear, she's fascinated by our reaction to our senses, a fascination that has led her to some unexpected places. But she began by telling me what she's been up to recently.
Judging a perfume prize at the moment, and I'm actually getting scents to judge, which is the most wonderful thing. And I'm reading this book, which is basically a sort of dictionary of all the scents that are currently available commercially. It's called Perfumes the Guide, and it's by Luca Turin, and there is a new edition of this that comes out every year. It sounds rather dull and dry. It's really not. It's hilarious. It's wonderfully expressed. There are pages of lyrical, wonderful, evocative prose about the scents that the authors like and the ones that they don't like. You have a one-line burn like smells like Windoline. And it's wonderful. It's a great book to just pick up and put down, and I think it is the one book that I have bought the most often because I keep wanting to give it to friends.
Oh, how fantastic. Well, I'm not altogether sure that one will be in the Talking Books library, but maybe I should recommend it to the librarians. That sounds fantastic.
It's well worth it. Thank you.
Out of curiosity, what did you think of Peter Suskind's book, Perfume?
Oh, I loved it.
You did?
I loved it. I thought it was something that I found in parts so overwhelming that I had to put it down. It was the only time that has happened to me. The sense impressions are so powerful and sometimes so troubling that I had to put it down because I have synesthesia.
Oh, right.
And because I smell colours and also sometimes words. Opening the book just felt like a blast of different sense impressions, and it was quite odd. I'd never read anything like it before.
No, it's funny. I too, actually found it very enjoyable, but actually a very difficult read, especially when he was in the cave and slowly decaying in some way. And actually, it did make me feel sick in the way that if you smell meat that's gone off.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
It's very powerful.
Very well translated.
Mm.
I mean, I kept forgetting that it was a translated book, which is, of course, the prime objective of any translator, to make you forget that that wasn't the original language. They made a hell of a good job of it.
Oh, it's wonderful, wasn't it? It was, no, an incredibly powerful book. There are certain images that are engraved into your mind's eye, I think.
Indeed. In fact, I think it was after reading that book that I decided to write Chocolat, because it struck me at that time that so little has been written about taste and scent compared to all the things that are written about the visuals and the things that you hear. And I thought, well, you know, why don't people do it? It must be hard. Let's give it a try.
Oh, right. Oh, that's fascinating. I can see exactly where the link is, but yeah.
It's nothing like that, and it's not the same kind of story, and it's not the same technique, but it's just the idea that you can take a sense that has been underused in fiction and build a story all around it.
It's funny, it's what I try and do with my fiction, just to show the fact that, yes, you're not sonically superpowered if you're blind.
No, absolutely.
But you co-opt the other senses to fill the gap.
I wrote a book called Blue Eyed Boy, which had a blind protagonist, and I had tremendous difficulty doing it because I realised, obviously, that I write visually. And it was a real challenge, but it was rather flattering when blind people wrote to me to say, we think you nailed this character, because I wasn't sure that I had. And I did spend a week wearing a blindfold and doing household tasks with a blindfold on, and that was a hell of an experience too, and not at all easy, as my finger ends found out.
Yes, I quite regularly have burns on the end of my fingers.
Exactly.
It is odd. I don't know if you wore the blindfold for long enough, but I can now take a joint of meat out of the oven and tell you just by the way it sounds and smells whether it's cooked.
I can usually tell whether things are cooked by the way they smell, because I have a kind of dog-like sense of smell. And I can usually tell if I'm upstairs and I can stand on top of the landing and smell it, then it's done.
Yeah, right.
If I can only smell it when I'm halfway down the stairs, then it's half done. That's basically how I work it out. I did this for 5 days, and it was the five longest days of my life. And I thought, I can't do this for any longer. I'll try and write the book on this. It certainly made me aware of certain things that I hadn't thought of before.
Well, I actually haven't read Blue Eyed Boy. I've read an awful lot of your other books.
It's a nasty
books,
book,
so...
I'm warning you, it's a nasty book.
Oh, well, that's okay, I'll give it a go. Funnily enough, it's Gentlemen and Players that is my favourite of yours. I've always loved that book.
Oh, I'm glad you like that. Well, Blue Eyed Boy is a sort of relative because it's set in the same play.
Oh, St Oswald's.
It's not set in St Oswald's, no, but it's set in Morbury. And,
right.
And it's a sort of relative to Gentlemen and Players and Different Class. One of the central characters in Blue Eyed Boy also pops up again in Different Class. So it's kind of in that area. And it is one of my three kind of unreliable narrator psychological thriller books. It's the one that I get the most hate mail about when people hate it.
Oh, no.
But also the one that I get most people coming and saying they think it's the best thing ever written. It's really strange. There's a great division there between people who can stomach that story and its darkness and people who really can't. But that's all right. I like things being a topic for discussion.
Yes, absolutely. I always feel that if you get a few letters, then you've touched a nerve, which is a good thing.
Oh, I got tons of letters for Blue Eyed Boy. I still do. I got accusations that I hadn't written it, my husband must have written it, that I put my name to somebody else's work, that I couldn't have written something quite so beastly. And lots of people just were confused, which I agree with. It's a confusing story if you're easily confused.
To be honest, being blind is a fairly confusing state to be in. So I think you
it jolly well is. Well, because it was a book that was all about perceptions
and
how perceptions can be wrong and how we subtly or not subtly tailor the way we are perceived by people in the way that we present ourselves to them.
Yeah, right.
It was all about that. It was all about obfuscation. It was that kind of story.
Oh, well, I now know what I'm going to be reading over Easter.
Tell me how you get on. You hate it, I won't be offended.
I'll drop you an email and let you know. It's very rare that I hate a book. I think it is the good thing about publishing. I think it keeps an awful lot of the dross away from the readers. So I think
It certainly does. And without wishing to put a downer on self-publishing, which is an excellent thing in so many ways, there's an awful lot of self-published stuff that isn't really very good.
Mm.
And it's quite hard to tell before you get it because there has been no selection process.
Yeah.
So you take a chance on something and you realise that it's awful 10 pages in, and then you take a chance on something else and that's awful 10 pages in. So, yeah, it swings and roundabout.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, there is a risk of alienating readers if there's too much self-publishing.
Well, yes and no. I think actually the way I'm reading things, I think it has resulted in some people not actually knowing whether something is well written or not. And not caring. I think that people who are involved in publishing notice these things. But I think it could well be that 80% of readers neither know nor care whether something is stylistically competent. They just want the story. I talk to an awful lot of younger people particularly who consider themselves to be great readers. But actually, it has been a long time since they read anything that wasn't either fan fiction or freely available, free of charge stuff online. And that's interesting because I think it's changing the expectation of the reader.
Okay. I will still be buying my daughter's books that I hear other people talk about, just in the hope that I will pull them back away from some of the darker stuff that they actually read and even write as fan fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind dark, but there is some stuff which is frankly toxic.
So yes, I think that's a better way of putting it.
I think there's an awful lot of very weird stuff that just things that I mean, I'm all for freedom of expression and all the rest of it, and I don't think we should be policing what people read, but it depends. If you read too much of something which just engenders either hatred or self-hatred or self-harm or toxic negative values, you can feel unbalanced by it.
I think it can normalise things that are
abnormalities.
I always think back to that, the case of the man who was a cannibal who found somebody else online who wanted to be eaten.
Yes, and that's right, I remember that.
Suddenly you think, gosh, you've actually created a community for these people.
You sure have. Well, this is the internet for you, of course. You know, it is, and it's the wonderful and also the slightly frightening thing about it. Whatever you are into, you know, however arcane or weird, whatever it is you're into, if you do want to reenact Pride and Prejudice with stormtroopers, then you will find somewhere the small community of people who is desperately into wanting to do that as well. Which is fine, but if you also want to destroy society, malign marginalised groups, get into the heads of young women and make them hate themselves, then you can do that too, and it's easy.
Exactly. The thing, people forget the power of suggestion, of the written and spoken word sometimes.
They do, and they also forget that the internet isn't the written word. It is something between the written and spoken word, and there is an intimacy to it, and an illusion of knowledge. Blue Eye Boy's all about this. There's a weird confessional thing about the internet that means that you tell people your secrets that you wouldn't tell them in real life. You wouldn't just tell some stranger you met on the bus what you were into sexually or that you had cancer or whatever. But people do this all the time online.
Because you're safe in your own room.
Because you think you're safe.
Well, sorry, yes, you feel you're safe, whereas
you're
actually
not remotely safe, really. You're physically safe most of the time, unless you are somebody who wants to be eaten by a cannibal.
Yes.
Or you are a young girl who thinks that you're talking to a young boy and actually you're talking to an old perv. There's an illusion of safety, an illusion of intimacy.
Yeah.
And it is quite worrying, I think. Much as I love it and much as I spend my life on it, There's all sorts of things that I wouldn't say online.
Yeah.
And I don't. I used to be part of a message board place, which was basically a fan group. And I found very interesting the number of things that were said to me without anyone knowing who I was or what would be done with that information if they just said things.
Yeah.
I got people's kind of secret lives, and I thought, you know what, perhaps you shouldn't be telling me this.
Yes. Well, especially not an author, actually, in some ways, because we're quite suggestible.
Exactly. Well, they didn't know I was
suggestible.
An author.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
this whole book came out of that, although I didn't actually use anything that I learned, but I did use that the ideas that I got from talking to people, and this idea that we build communities online and we behave in them much as we do in communities offline, but without any sense of consequence. And so if some toxic individual enters one of these communities with nothing to lose, then they can do a lot of harm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gosh, well, thank you. I very much look forward to reading Blue Eyed Boy. That was a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed having a chat this morning.
I really do
appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to Joanne Harris. A wide selection of her books, including The Blue-Eyed Boy, are available from the RNIB Library. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the Action Line on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
Viewing the web journal of Blue Eyed Boy, posting on Bad Guys Rock at webjournal.com. Posted at 0256 on Monday, January the 28th. Status, public. Mood, nostalgic. Listening to Captain Beefheart, Ice Cream for Crow. The colour of murder is blue, he thinks. Ice blue. Smokescreen blue, frostbite, postmortem, body bag blue. It is also his colour in so many ways, running through his circuitry like an electrical charge, screaming blue murder all the way. Blue colours everything. He sees it, senses it everywhere, from the blue of his computer screen to the blue of the veins on the backs of her hands, raised now and twisted like the tracks of sandworms on Blackpool Beach, where they used to go, the four of them, every year on his birthday. And he would have an ice cream cone and paddle in the sea and search out the little scuttling crabs from under the piles of seaweed and drop them into his bucket to die in the heat of the simmering birthday sun. Today he is only 4 years old, and there is a peculiar innocence in the way he carries out these small and guiltless slayings. There is no malice in the act, merely a keen curiosity for the scuttling thing that tries to escape, sidling round and round the base of the blue plastic bucket, then, hours later, giving up the fight, claws splayed, and turning its vivid underbelly upwards in a futile show of surrender, by which time he has long since lost interest and is eating a coffee ice cream, a sophisticated choice for such a little boy, but vanilla has never been his taste, so that when he rediscovers it at the end of the day, when the time comes to empty his bucket and to go home, he is vaguely surprised to find the creature dead and wonders, indeed, how such a thing could ever have been alive at all.
Owen Shaw narrating Blue-Eyed Boy, written by my guest, Joanne Harris. Blue-Eyed Boy, which is all one word, is TB17736. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen. And I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. And I remember that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation.
one of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny, it was a joy to read.
Studio B was the snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B.
I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the RNIB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Rūta Sepetys is a Lithuanian-American author whose novel Salt to the Sea won the 2017 Philip Carnegie Medal. It's a haunting account of the worst maritime disaster in history, the sinking of a ship packed with refugees at the end of World War II. She joined me down the line from her home in Nashville to share the books of her life. So, Rūta, was there a book that inspired you to become a writer?
There was. And that book was James and the Giant Peach by Roald Dahl. I read it and it absolutely enchanted me with the idea of writing and creativity.
Here we go, shouted the old green grasshopper, hopping up and down with excitement. Hold on tight. What's happening? Cried James, leaping out of his hammock. What's going on? The ladybird, who was obviously a kind and gentle creature, came over and stood beside him. In case you don't know it, she said, we are about to depart forever from the top of this ghastly hill that we've all been living on for so long. We are about to roll away inside this great, beautiful peach to a land of what? Asked James. Never you mind, said the ladybird, but nothing could be worse than this desolate hilltop and those two repulsive aunts of yours. Here, here, they all shouted. Here, here.
Roald Dahl reading his book James and the Giant Peach, which is TB6212. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread?
There is, and that book would be West with the Night by Beryl Markham, who was a pilot in East Africa around the 1920s and was truly just a remarkable woman. And the book West with the Night is a bit of a memoir of her adventures. And it is a book full of adventure and intrigue. And I absolutely love that book.
How is it possible to bring order out of memory? I should like to begin at the beginning, patiently, like a weaver at his loom. I should like to say, this is the place to start. There can be no other. But there are 100 places to start for. There are 100 names. Mwanza, Serengeti, Nungwe, Molo, Nakuru. There are easily 100 names, and I can begin best by choosing one of them. Not because it is first, nor of any importance in a wildly adventurous sense, but because here it happens to be, turned uppermost in my logbook. After all, I am no weaver, Weavers create. This is remembrance. Revisitation. And names are keys that open corridors no longer fresh in the mind, but nonetheless familiar in the heart. So, the name shall be Nungwe, as good as any other. Entered like this in the log, lending reality, if not order, to memory. Date, 16th of the 6th, 35. Type aircraft, Avro Avian. Markings, VP, KAN. Journey, Nairobi to Nungwe.
West with the Night by Beryl Malcolm is TB8312. And a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I read Wolf Hollow, which was also shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal. Wolf Hollow is written by Lauren Wolk, and I am so taken with this book. I think it's absolutely beautiful. It's been compared in the United States to To Kill a Mockingbird. And I really believe this will be a book that will endure, and already it's become an instant classic.
It was the autumn of 1943 when my steady life began to spin, not only because of the war that had drawn the whole world into a screaming brawl, but also because of the dark-hearted girl who came to our hills and changed everything. At times, I was so confused that I felt like the stem of a pinwheel surrounded by whir and clatter, but through that whole unsettling time I knew that it simply would not do to hide in the barn with a book and an apple and let events plunge forward without me.
Wolf Hollow by Lauren Wolk is TB405740, and it's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. Ruta Sepetys, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Ruta Sepetys. Salt of the Sea is available from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB405739. Don't forget, you too can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.